Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Neil Haley Show, and again, my website, totaltutor.net, for more information, Twitter, totaltutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, the Author's Corner segment, and I think this is probably the largest, most well-known author I've ever had on my program. I've had some amazing authors in the Miami Book Fair. This guest has 14 New York Times best-selling books. Sold so many different books, but I like the fact that he was born and raised in Pennsylvania. So I'm excited to welcome the program New York Times bestselling author Dean Koontz. Dean, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I woke up alive this morning, so that's the best it can be.
Well, you got to wake up alive and you're ready to go. And it must be amazing to look back at your career and look at where you started in Shippensburg area and things like that in Pennsylvania to where you are today as being such a successful author. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, when my wife many years ago said, look, I know you don't want to teach school. I know you want to write novels. I'll support you for 5 years, and if you can't make it in five, you'll never make it. And I seized the moment and did that. We just thought if I could ever make $25,000 a year on a regular basis, that would be great success. So everything that happened since then is an amazement to us every day, and I can't believe we've gone from where we were to where we are, but it's been a journey of love between a husband and wife and a love of what we do and a love of writing, which I can't believe I've been so fortunate.
So a question about education, your background. So you were thinking about becoming a teacher, a professor? Is that what you were looking at first when you were looking at colleges and stuff back in the day, Dean?
I never had the grand idea of being a professor. I was going to be a high school English teacher, and I worked for a year in the poverty program as a tutor for kids in very bad situations, and then a year and a half in the Mechanicsburg School District. And I was selling short stories and a couple of paperback novels and thought there was this other thing I was more interested in. But I did start out in education, yep.
Well, my uncle lives in Mechanicsburg, and I'm familiar with Mechanicsburg, so I think that's so cool. I'll have to let him know. And my grandmother grew up in Lemoyne, and my mom grew up in Lemoyne, so I know that area very, very well. So I'll have to mention that to them. And it's interesting. So a teacher, and then you just said your love was writing. So once you became successful, it must have been amazing, right, to see that people really enjoyed your books.
As I said, we had very modest goals when we set out, and I say to young writers, don't ever think about trying to write what's popular. Don't raise the periscope and scope the market. Write what you particularly are passionate about writing, and it may take a long time, and you may get passionate about different things. I certainly did. I started out writing small science fiction novels and eventually moved to suspense and wrote a comic novel and found my way toward a kind of mix of genres. And one day it just all started coming together and in ways that were astonishing. I remember the first time a publisher called me up and said, you're going to be number one in the New York Times. And before I could be even excited about it, she said, but don't think this will ever happen again. You're not the kind of writer who makes number one. And so she brought me crashing down at the very moment she brought me up, but she was wrong. We had number one bestsellers together after that, and then with other publishers, even more of them. So it's just finding your way to the thing that works for you, and sometimes that can take a while. I wrote for many years before I was on the bestseller list.
Wow. So we're talking today about his new book, Saint Odd, and the Odd Thomas series. And it really what's interesting about it, Dean, is basically this is going to be the conclusion. So how does that feel that this is going to be the conclusion book?
Well, when the first book came to me, I was working on another novel, and into my head came the lines, my name is Odd Thomas, I lead an unusual life. And it had nothing to do with the novel I was writing, but I knew it was the start of something. So I turned to a yellow legal tablet I keep beside me, and I never write longhand, but suddenly I started writing longhand. And I wrote 30-some pages longhand, which became the first chapter of the novel. And the character so appealed to me. I had no idea where he had come from, where this story had come from. It was almost mystical to me. And when I finished the first novel, I said, this is probably going to be a trilogy. I never saw it was going to be 8 books. But I've loved every single one of them because the character is so appealing to me. And getting him to the final book, I always knew there had to be a final book. It couldn't go on forever. Has been a journey of discovery for the character, for me, and I'm happy that I've gotten him to a nice place because I love the character and think he deserves a good ending.
Oh, definitely. And to learn a little bit for our listeners out there who have not read the Odd Thomas series, it's about journey, and he's born to serve a purpose. That's really what Odd Thomas is about, right? Am I correct?
Odd is an unusual character to be driving this a series with a lot of action in it. He's not a giant 6'5" mesomorph that weighs 225 pounds. He's a normal-sized guy. He doesn't particularly like guns, but he sometimes has to use them. He's very humble. He has a complicated life because he has the ability to see the spirits of the lingering dead, who sometimes come to him for justice because they might have been murdered, or for help crossing over to the other side because they're afraid to make that move. And his life is kind of weird because of all this. So he simplifies it by being a fry cook. And even sometimes thinks being a fry cook is too complicated. He might have to go into tire sales just to further simplify his life. But he's always moving forward. So the stories are, in a way, mystical. They have a spiritual element to them. But it's always, one reviewer said, Thomas is actually two words that mean devotion to your fellow man. And that is sort of what this character is about. He's moving through life trying to do the best he can for the people around him.
And has ordinary type jobs. So he's an ordinary person that truly believes his life's purpose is to help others, it sounds like. Correct?
Yeah, but extraordinary things happen to him, and he's always seems to be at death's doorstep, which is, but he can cope. And there was a promise in the first book, here's a spoiler alert, in the first book he loses the love of his life, Stormy Llewellyn, who dies, and he, however, gets a card from a gypsy fortune-telling machine in a carnival that says the two of you are destined to be together forever. And I always felt that was a promise, that in the final book of the series, that would occur. And how that could possibly happen, I didn't really know until I got to the 8th book. And I'm hopeful that no reader will figure it out until they read it. But it was really a hoot to finally bring him there.
It definitely sounds like it in so many ways. And the very interesting character. So the type of mythical types of things that happen and tragedy. Do you see Odd Thomas in you at all, Dean?
One of the things when I was a young writer, I said, no, your characters aren't you. But to a degree, the characters are you to an extent. Now, I'm not the vicious, savage killers that he encounters, but Odd's sense of the world, that the life is mysterious, the world is a place of wonder, those are certainly the same things I feel about the world. And so in some ways, Odd represents my view of things.
All right, well, fantastic, Dean. Where's the best place we can find information on you, purchase your book, and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Well, you go to www.deankuntz.com, or I have a Facebook page, Dean Kuntz Official, and we've got, but the website's probably the best, and the book, hopefully it's available everywhere, or otherwise I'm going to have to whoop some butt.
Well, I think it's going to be available everywhere, Dean, and you just constantly are writing books, aren't you? That's pretty much what you do a lot of time, don't you, Dean? Always coming up with a new story, new book to write, right?
There's more stories. I have a drawer where when an idea occurs to me and I don't have time to get to it right now, I write it down and throw it in a drawer. There's probably 100 novel ideas in the drawer that I'll never get to, so it's... I've always got to be writing, and it keeps me out of trouble with the cops, so it's a good thing.
Well, keep up the great work. keep writing. Great to see a Pennsylvania guy, especially from, again, the Mechanicsburg area, doing very successful for himself. So best of luck, Dean, and we'll have you back for your next book. So thanks again for calling.
Okay, thank you for having me there.
All right, take care, Dean. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. You're watching The Neil Haley Show and listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just... Back to The Neil Haley Show. What an amazing interview with Dean Koontz. Absolutely amazing guy. And great to see the local connection of where my mom grew up in central PA. Great guy for sure. And now we continue. And I love working with the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust and helping them promote certain events that are coming up. And one that's really big is coming up to the Benenham Center January 20th to 25th. Trust.org to find out more information. Pippin the Musical will be there, and it's a 4-time Tony Award-winning show. Fantastic. We had an awesome guest before, but I want to welcome the program Sasha Allen from also season 4 of The Voice, and an actress and much, much more. Sasha, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm happy to have you on the program, and amazing, I guess, your career, wouldn't you say? The different things you've been able to accomplish in such a short period of time. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, actually, definitely. Things have been going really well for me at the moment. Yes.
Yeah, so basically when, and we're going to get right to Pippin because I got some definitely interesting questions about Pippin, but looking at your background and stuff, growing up, did you always want to be a performer, an actress, a singer, and all that stuff?
Yes, actually. I guess my mom was the one that actually saw the twinkle in my eye, and then we kind of went for it. So I have to thank her for it, yes.
And growing up, were you involved in all different types of productions, dance, singing, all these different things, constantly performing?
Constantly performing, constantly trying new things, new projects, even as a child. I think that these things really help, you know, while you're in school, to do extracurricular things that really made me happy. So, yeah, I was always busy, constantly.
How were you able to balance study in that, in certain ways, in school and stuff, especially in like high school, middle school, elementary, with being involved in all those activities?
For high school, I went to LaGuardia, which is a performing arts high school. But I kind of feel like if it's something that you love and it's something that comes naturally and naturally brings you joy, that it doesn't interfere with anything, you know. It is what you want to do instead of playing outside. You want to do that, you know.
Right. So you made sure that your studies were in order, through grammar school and things like that, so that you could do all these things, right? Because I'm sure your parents saw education as an important thing growing up.
He's a principal. So, yes, she thinks it's very important.
A principal. Interesting. Yeah. And so,
yeah.
And were you in the same school as she was principal at one point in time, or?
So funny. By the time she came to the school that I was at for grammar school, I was gone. My brother, on the other hand, wasn't as lucky, but she's still actually the principal of the school now. So
interesting story how you got to the States, for sure. I mean, thinking about The Voice and everything like that, how did that story come up, that and getting into acting in the States and all that, and kind of leaving France to do all this? How'd that happen? How did that happen? How did you decide to go to the States and be part of The Voice and doing all these different things? How being led from where you grew up to the U.S., how did that journey begin?
Auditioning for The Voice was a situation where you kind of like, should I do this? Should I not do this? Will this help me or not? It really, really helped. So it was kind of a, I think we should just do this kind of thing. I had 2 children, you know, and I had to think about leaving them and doing all these. I do those things hoping that it will better my family as well as myself. It turned out to be one of the best decisions I've ever made. It's stretched me completely. The amount of pressure that I was under was incredible. The music that I got to share and other people that got to see me, it was an experience that I'm very thankful for, because in a small amount of time, a mass amount of people were able to see me, and I was able to share my gifts with them.
Wow.
But as far as it comes about, I don't think it's something that you plan, really. It feels like an opportunity that comes, and then you say, turn around to your friends and family and say, so what do you guys think? Yes? No?
Yeah.
Yes? But, I mean, it was something like that. I'm from New York City, so there's always opportunity. There's always all these things, but this felt like the grand opportunity, and so I went for it.
So how did you move to New York City? How old were you when you moved to New York?
I'm born and raised.
Born and raised. Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in so many ways. So let's continue with the conversation with Sasha Allen from Pippin the Musical. So you had those opportunities coming through so much in growing up in New York City and all these different certain situations. Once The Voice happened, your career took off, didn't it? Right after The Voice.
The Voice really propelled it. I think all the doors that, sometimes you're not sure if you can open, and not that you didn't want to, now open a lot easier, because of The Voice. I think it's just a great platform to show people the extent of your performance and how much pressure you can take and, what people will like and won't like, because it's already been tested.
Definitely.
It's been great.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then you started performing, acting, doing musicals. Now being part of the Pippin, it must be an amazing experience, isn't it? Traveling with this musical, isn't it?
It's completely beautiful. It stretched me completely. I've toured with pop artists before, as like a background singer and doing stuff like that. But this is almost exactly like doing something like The Voice, where your voice has to be, in tip-top shape at all times. And as mine right now sounds a little hoarse, what I mean?
Yeah.
There are these kind of pressures of the weather and, it's cold, and if somebody in the cast gets sick, then we all get sick. But...
Exactly. And I already could tell. I could tell with the someone gets sick, and that's got to be tough. That's when that happens in the cast. There's like, get away, especially if you're one of the big stars. You don't want to be next to somebody that has the flu,
it's
right?
It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard. Yeah.
Because the music.
Because I mean, so you could come in, an acrobat, and
because
maybe feel under the weather. But if I feel under the weather, then I can't sing. So it all becomes difficult. And these all turn into like life lessons.
Exactly. And
you can stand, and all these things, and to still be able to smile and try to put a performance on.
And Pippin is such an amazing, I had Callum Bergman on, and he taught me so much about Pippin in certain ways, of just all the theatricals, and he was explaining it to me. But I want to hear your explanation of this performance. I mean, because it's supposed to take place in medieval times, yet it's not really in medieval times, and there's so much amazing things going on during the performance, acrobatic feats to great music, to dancing, all those different things. How would you describe it, Sasha?
If I were to put it simply, it is about a young man who is trying to find fulfillment and find his way. And he finds a troupe, and he finds this woman who he allows to lead him through all these different channels to see if he can find fulfillment. We are all looking for fulfillment in some way, I think. And that's why we have careers and we keep moving, families, and I always say that that we continue to do down with someone. So I think that the story, actually, the dancing, the singing, the acrobatics, the colors, you know, all those are all details, beautiful details. It's colored beautifully. Mm-hmm. But for a story that I think everybody feels like that they have probably been through at some time in their life,
right.
And you feel lost, and you feel like you're not quite sure where you belong or what you're supposed to be doing in life, and only you can answer for yourself, and the parents can't answer it anymore. And I think that's the beauty in the show, is that there is like a serious, you know, lesson or story or something that we can all relate to, and then it's colored beautifully.
Exactly, in that journey. So tell us your role that you play in Pippin the Musical. What's your part?
I play, I would say, a narrator slash the woman that is taking him on this journey to find his fulfillment. Now, the way I go about doing it is almost turning doing everything so much, you know. It's like having chocolate. It doesn't have to be a bad thing unless you, you know, eat a bucket of it. But I take him and take all these lessons and take them so far to try to direct him to what I think fulfillment is. And without giving it away, I am trying to control him, trying to control what I think he should be doing. And at the end of the day, it's up to him.
Exactly.
And that's nice.
Doesn't a lot of women try to control guys?
Oh, no.
I try to lead them in the right direction so that we're not just so clueless. Teach us specifically how to parent it ways, and teach us how to get up on time, shave, make sure that we're not presenting ourselves in the wrong way. So women do that, but your role was more, let's lead you to a journey. Let's lead Pip into this journey.
Let's lead you to a journey that I'm going to control by making everything not so much fun.
Oh, jeez. So what do you think of your character? Why is your character like that in so many ways? What do you think? Can you kind of describe
that?
She has
a show to put on, right? She's the ring master. She has a show to put on. And she wants to get to a destination through his... you know, him being naive. So she's being manipulative. She's not the nicest at all. She's trying to show the audience something. And he just so happens to be the person that is going to show them today, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, I think it's a great story with lots of depth and, like, creepiness almost. My character, I get to really dive into so many different shades. Because she turns on him.
And the whole circus part of this, the word circus, again, I was a former professional wrestler, so I was in a kind of that type of a circus atmosphere going to different places all over the U.S. and sometimes the world, and you wouldn't expect when you perform all those different things. And you'd say to yourself... whoever the promoter, the professional wrestling promoter. It sounds like, Sasha, that was kind of you leading Pippin in so many ways, taking the direction of manipulation and different things, and that's what the circus does, right? it's a three ring craziness, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'm thrilled that she chose to be doing this character because I get to take the audience and the cast on whatever trip I'm feeling like at the moment. You know, lines, but it's really based on the energy that's happening at the moment. And, I would say, I guess it is like wrestling is like the circus as well. You're entertaining.
Exactly, yeah. And that's
you're
what...
you're entertaining.
And that's the...
and not necessarily for the betterment of your co-host here. I'm putting him on display.
And that's the theater, entertainment. So a lot of ways, Pippin speaks to what performing is in so many ways. So, Sasha, yeah, where's absolutely. The best place we can find information on you? I know we can go to trust.org to find information about the performance at the Benenum Center January 20th to 25th for our viewing audience in Pittsburgh and listening audience in Pittsburgh, but all over the world, where's the best place to find you, Sasha?
I guess you can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, and just Google Sasha Allen, and I am there. I would love for people to see this project. It is absolutely amazing, and it is definitely worth your time.
Well, thanks for taking the time. Get your voice better. Don't say another word to your next practice. And feel better. And hopefully you'll be perfectly fine by January 20th in Pittsburgh. So good talking to you, Sasha.
I love you.
Okay, take care.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, that was the Neil Haley Show. Another amazing guest. You look at Dean Koontz and Sasha Allen. How can I top it next week? Who knows? Or the rest of the weeks, or when I tape in February or March, I will be on it. Trust me. You never know who will call the Neil Haley Show. And you also go to my website, Tolter.net, for more information. Twitter, Tolter, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And I'm really looking at my viewing audience. We know about how engaged my listeners are. But my viewers, please tweet me, hashtag BPTV at Total Tutor, and we can find out what guests do you want to see, especially local. Who do you want me to interview? Trust me, we have Pierre LaRouche, so we're adding this big list. So take care, guys. We'll talk next week with some more great talk on the Neil Haley Show. Take care, everyone. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google Plus, Neil Haley. And hey, it's Throwback Thursday, right? So my wife last week shows me a picture with my favorite coach of all time growing up, Coach Jackie Sherrill. And I said to my wife, I'm going to have him on my show next week, so I got to post this on Facebook. So I have this interview, which I'm so excited. So I'm excited to welcome the program, Coach Jackie Sherrill. The days at the University of Pittsburgh, I think you were 11-1, three straight years. I consider it, even though it's not on Wikipedia, that you shared the national championship in 81. Coach Sherrill, thanks for calling. How are you?
I appreciate that, and thank you for having me on. And ironically, in 79 and 81, the New York Times and two other publications picked us number one, but since we lost that one game, we didn't win the national championship.
But I think it still should say it's an honor and award because you were ranked number one in some of the publications, especially 81. So, and you know, if it was these days, you would be playing for you'd be in a playoff game for sure, and you made it to the playoffs in the final. So, well, you know, it all develops for sure.
Well, I was fortunate because we had a lot of great players.
Oh, it was amazing.
And that really made a big difference.
It was an amazing team. So, did you always want to be a coach, Coach Sherrill?
No, I went to the University of Alabama, started in biology, and then I rebelled like most kids did from parents, and I switched to business, Ace Accounting 1, Ace Accounting 2, and I said, this is easy, I'll be a CPA, and then I took cost in theory. My theory wasn't the same as that professor's.
And so you had other ideas then, right?
Well, no, I ended up finishing all my requirements in business, general business, okay. And then my roommate, Steve Sloan, was getting a certificate in business ed, and so I just went ahead and also got a certificate, so the degree's in business ed. But I started selling insurance my senior year in college, and I was going into the business world. I started my master's at Alabama and went from there to Arkansas to finish it. Coach Majors was at Arkansas. He got the head coaching job at Iowa State, and I was fortunate enough that he asked me to join him. I did, and three years later, I was the assistant head coach and defensive coordinator.
And you were at the right place, right time. Coach Majors leaves, and you get to inherit an unbelievable program and continue to take it to the next level, where it had some ups and downs, Coach Sherrill, going into it. Because, I mean, after 76, Pitt was pretty good, but you took that national championship in 76 and really recruited some players to go around to continue this tradition that developed through 76, I think.
Yeah, the 77 recruiting class probably will go down as the all-time class at the University of Pittsburgh. 1980, we had three in the first round, 11 in the first seven, and 18 players off that team was in pro camps, you know, drafted. So, you know, if the head coach had been smarter or better, they probably would have won the national championship two or three times. And I don't remember who that guy was.
But so, and again, we could talk about the one game, that one game for sure in all this. So that, so basically what happened, the way you were able to get the Pitt coaching job was the opportunity to be on Coach Major's staff. Coach Major leaves, then it's your job. There you go, right?
Yes. Well, in 1976, I was the head coach at Washington State. And when they interviewed me, they asked me, because they didn't know how long I would stay, some of the people had put that in their minds. And I said there'd be two programs that I would leave for, and that would be the University of Pittsburgh and University of Alabama. And they didn't think either one of those would come open. And sure enough, Coach Majors leaves, goes to Tennessee, and they bring me back as the head coach at Pittsburgh. And, you know, going in and recruiting, I remember we didn't have any coaches at that time. I was on the phone calling all the recruits. And if you were not being recruited by Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan, I went on to the next player. And we ended up getting 22 out of the Northeast, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. We got Mark May out of New York, which right. was a great get, meaning, you know, today there'd be no question that he would have been a five-star player. And then we were able to go down south because of my connections in the south and get kids out of Mississippi, out of Georgia, and one out of Mississippi was Hugh Green, which what? Ended up winning, yeah, finishing second in the Heisman, but he probably should have won it.
He should have won it, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, George Rogers won the Heisman, and so we played South Carolina in the Gator Bowl, and I think George only had 38 yards, you know, in the first half, or 38 yards the total, and so there's no question. But we were very fortunate. Then in 81, we were number one in the country for, I think, 7 weeks, and then we played Penn State.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, I made some dumb mistakes of, you know, saying we got Danny, we'll win it. And, you know, they were dropping 9 people, and we were still throwing the ball instead of running it. So, but anyway, that helped us, or helped me, because when we went to the Sugar Bowl and played Georgia, you know, Herschel only had like 68 yards, I believe, or 78 yards, and our running back had 148 yards. And Danny came back down the field and at the end of the game, and the ball was on the 34-yard line. I called timeout, brought Danny over and said, Danny, we got two choices. Either we'll kick a field goal, tie the game, and try to get the ball back and win it in overtime, or we can go for it. And he looked me right square in the eye, and he said, Coach, we're not here to tie this game.
All right.
And so, you know, that's when we actually were throwing a pick. We were taking the two backs and cross them and to pick the linebackers to make the first down. But they blitzed eighth. The two backs had to stay in and block, and that's and a tight end and a flanker and X receiver running takeoffs, and that's when he threw the pass to Tom Brown for the touchdown.
Oh, and it was what an unbelievable moment in Pitt history. There's not many
as big as that, I believe.
The big thing about it was everybody had to do their assignment. You had to block, and there was one person that was free. And Danny knew that he had one guy that would be free. He knew where he was coming from. Instead of taking the normal 7-step drive, Danny took 9 steps to get back far enough and quick enough to get rid of the football.
And then the moment of moments. Would you say that was your greatest moment as coach at Pitt? Was that play? Would you say?
I think it was a huge play. There's no question. And even today, people still figure that's the play in the Sugar Bowl, in the history of the Sugar Bowl. And I remember certainly when you played Georgia, and Georgia was at Herschel Walker, and it was a big moment for everybody.
Definitely a big moment for everybody. And then you go on to coach years for 2 different teams, Texas A&M and Mississippi State. But those years at Pitt were absolutely amazing. But when you had to finally say it's time for me to hang it up, meaning as a coach, was that difficult to retire? Or did you have ideas of something else, what you wanted to do after that?
Well, I always thought that I would retire by the age of 60. And when I retired, I still did radio and TV. I did a radio show on the Big 12. We had 43 stations. And then I went to Fox Southwest in a studio analyst and did that for 3 years. But I still do radio and TV and write and still much involved. And I was one of the voters on the Harris poll at one time.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So you're still involved in, did you ever think of being media in your career? Did you think when, you were being interviewed all the time that you would end up being a member of the media?
No. I remember when I first showed up on Radio Row, and I was sitting there at my station, and I kept seeing all the media come by and looking at me and saying, oh, no, he's one of us now.
Were you liked by the media when you were coached, Coach Cheryl?
They always said I could talk for 2 hours and never answer the question. So the answer, I don't think I was, because I never gave them the answer that they wanted.
So you saw education as a really important part of your life, it sounds like, meaning you were going on your way to, a business degree and then somehow things changed thanks to Coach Johnny Majors. So you played football in college and stuff like that, correct, Coach Cheryl?
I played for Coach Bryant, and, we won the national championship in 64, 65, and I'm very indebted. I had the opportunity to play and coach for Coach Bryant, Coach Bowles, and Coach Majors. So I had 3 great head coaches.
And then you ended up being, and this is where I'm going to start putting my pitch out for Coach Cheryl. I believe in so many ways, Coach Cheryl, you're not, for what you have done in your career and all the different areas, people have to consider you for one of the great coaches, in my opinion. And looking at, what's written up and different things, you look at your years at Pitt, you look at your accomplishments of some of the coaching tree that were part of your staff, right, that have gone on to great success as coaches.
Jimmy Johnson was one of them that was on our Pitt staff. We can go on and on, but I was very fortunate to have outstanding coaches and outstanding players.
Most definitely. But like I said, the Pitt team just kept rolling on and on and on. And when you left, it broke my heart. I just had to say that because I was like, I was only 8 years old. And I said to myself, I know for a fact I knew football. And I said, oh, my, are we ever going to replace someone as great as he was? And well,
I appreciate that. And, they've struggled over the years. No question.
And it's something where hopefully this Coach Narduzzi brings the program back. He has a fire about him, and I believe that if you get the opportunity with the right coaching staff and place, you're going to win. So we'll see what happens for sure. Coach Cheryl, so you're doing all those different things. Are you doing any charity work as well?
Yes. We started a 12-man foundation. That's from our 12-man kickoff team. and foundation where we give scholarships, and you know, they've given in 5 years they've given almost 100,000 to kids to go to college, Texas A&M. They started an ALS clinic in, or seed money to start an ALS clinic in Round Rock, Texas, and that was given about 135. We give money every year to Children's Hospital and the Scottish Rite in Dallas, and we go to the hospitals around the state of Texas, and we're the only group that MD Anderson out of Houston will allow to come in and touch their kids. Oh. And we put on a circus for them every year, and so we're there for about two and a half hours. We go to Scottish Rite in Dallas and do a kind of a deal with those kids for about 4 hours.
Well, that's tremendous, all the different things. Where is the best place we can find you, Coach Cheryl? Is it kind of just reaching out to you specifically? Is there, do you have a website or anything that we could find it
from? Yeah, you can. I started a business called Game On Sports Nutrition, but I'm just, as you said, I'm just getting ready to kick off a website. You know, people have been pushing me for years, and finally I agreed. But, you know, internet-wise, you know, my email is very simple, JackieCheryl@BellSouth, and live in Wimberley, Texas. That's at between Austin and San Antonio.
All right. Well, you really brought back memories, and it was great to hear about how humble you are, you know, bringing up specific years and how you had great players. That's what a leader is. A great leader is able to say, I had a lot of people help me for my great ride, for sure. And I tell you, that wiki needs to make some changes for sure. Like you're a national champion, first of all, with Coach Bryant, and in my opinion, you're a national champion with the Pitt Panthers as well. So they have to make some changes and write up some more stuff, and that's the problem about Wikipedia. But you could definitely get that website up and show all the amazing things you've done as a coach and then also as an analyst. And thanks again for calling, Coach Cheryl.
I appreciate it. Talk to you later.
All right, take care. You're welcome. Bye-bye. All right. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And we continue with some great celebrity interviews. And I tell you, when you talk about the amazing Mets of 1986, the characters, the cast of characters, I talked to Ed Hearn about the stories, but now I'm really excited to welcome the program 1986 World Series champion, Barry Lines. Barry, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm doing great, Neil. Great to be on with you. Looking forward to our conversations, and like I said, thanks again for having me on with you.
Absolutely. And we, you know, when Barry, when we talk about that team, did you know something was special that year? Did something come up that said, you know what, I know this is going to be a special team?
Well, that was my first taste of Major League Baseball. I made the team coming out of spring training after playing Double A the year before and having a terrific year personally in the Mets organization. But I think it was building. You know, at the Major League level, when Davey Johnson came over, 84 was a much better year than the Mets had enjoyed in quite some time. And then 85, they got close. They brought in Gary Carter, and, you know, some of the missing pieces came together. But 86, the expectations were very high going into spring training. I can remember Davey's speech to the team down in spring training was, you know, he fully expected the team to win, not only to win, but to dominate and to be champions. I mean, the talent level was, you know, at an all-time high for the organization, and the excitement was there, and everything was just magnified to a point that the expectations were that the New York Mets would be champions in 86, and, you know, as history would tell you, we were.
And so you had that feeling. You had that feeling, but it being your first year, what an amazing opportunity, right? You go, you're brought up to the Mets, and you're like, wow. And you're with these players, and you're saying, look at the performance, and how can I contribute for this amazing team, right?
Well, it was. I mean, it was, somewhat awe-inspiring, if you will, to be in the clubhouse and, you know, with that many superstar players, that many guys that, were recognizable not only in New York or in the National League or in the eastern part of the United States, but really all over the country. We had a cast of amazing players, but also a cast of characters. And certainly the performance on the field and the victories and the championships that was won certainly was on the back pages of the tabloids. But certainly the characters, both the good times and the fun times, and unfortunately the bad times, and a lot of struggles that many of us went through in years after that came to light and garnered headlines. But the Mets team, I hold every one of those guys as dear friends, and collectively we all love each other and all cherish those memories of that season and that era of the New York Mets baseball team.
Now, so you were talking about the cast of characters and how different they were from where you grew up. Was this a different crew to be around, for sure? Being, from the South, and, you get here with different guys, different backgrounds from different cities, different situations. I know you saw that in the minors, but now you're seeing these professionals that are playing at a high level. And if someone played a lot of years and you're a rookie in that type of environment, was that tough for you?
I don't say it was tough. Coming up through the minor league, with the Mets at that time, at every level, the Mets organization was producing championships. And, I, as a Mets player, I was a part of a single A championship, a double A, triple A, and of course a major league world championship. So winning was a part of the culture there, and the culture certainly was mixed, and the diversity of athletes from all over the country and all walks of life, and was a neat environment to be a part of. I mean, we had guys, from California and the surfer type guys. We had some thugs in there, just to be perfectly honest with you. We had some good old southern redneck boys, and we had some northern guys that were heartened by their upbringing, and we had a couple of Latin guys. It was a very diverse group of people from different cultures and different walks of life, but we all pulled together. And even though some guys maybe didn't get along with some guys off the field, once we put the uniform on and stepped out onto the ball field, there was only one goal in mind, and that was to win, and to kick ass, basically, was our motto. It wasn't just to win, but we wanted to kick the other club's ass on a daily basis.
And that was, in
later years, seemed to be secondary to what was going on off the field, to be perfectly honest with you. Having won that year and then being the world champions and being in New York City at a time when the Yankees were really down, the New York Mets were the talk
exactly.
of not only New York,
yeah.
the talk of all of baseball. And everywhere we went as a club, we had Mets fans following us and legions of fans that went on the road with us. It was a great time to be a New York Met.
It definitely was, Barry. And the one question I think that everyone asks you about is the World Series against the Red Sox. Your fondest memory, almost thinking it's over, right? You thought, oh, no, we're not going to get this championship. Kind of take us to that place and what you were thinking.
Well, that was more or less exactly what I was thinking. I actually was injured. I had broken my forearm in early August of that year, so I was not in uniform. As a matter of fact, Ed Hearn and I competed, for the backup job behind Carter that year, and I won the job spring training. And was there a month. Ed came up a month. I went to play. And anyway, we kind of split time in the middle of the season. But unfortunately, I got hurt. And so I was not in uniform, but I was there. As a matter of fact, I was standing in a little tunnel runway right behind home plate watching that as the ball trickled through Buckner's legs and the place went absolutely berserk. But I had a neat vantage point that I could see in the Red Sox dugout and the celebratory mood that was going on in there and the anticipation of running out on the field and you know, winning that championship. And obviously I had a bad feeling in my gut. And looking over at our dugout and the Mets dugout, it was pretty somber. And, you know, as Gary got a hit, as the inning began to unfold, you know, you could sense a little more excitement and a little more energy and all of a sudden, boom, you know, the wild pitch and then, you know, the ball goes through Buckner's legs. I mean, it was pandemonium to say the least, but it was an incredible moment in baseball history, as you see over and over and over, that play is shown.
Yes, truly. You got to see that participation. You got to be there. You got to be on that team and to remember that moment, which is tremendous, them winning that championship. Now, Barry, what are you currently doing? What's going on with you right now?
Well, I've been very involved in my local community in baseball and working with kids and developing programs over the last many years. But 20 years ago, I planted the seed to bring minor league baseball to my hometown of Biloxi. And by the grace of God and a whole lot of trials and tribulations and trial and error, that dream is going to be realized. I'm not directly involved in it now, but this was something that I was passionate about seeing for my hometown. So that's part of what I've been doing. I've also I'm going to manage the Bristol Blues in Bristol, Connecticut this summer at the Collegiate Summer League in Bristol, and I'm going to manage that, and I'm going to test the water, so to speak, and see if getting back in the game at the professional level and hopefully maybe working with the Mets again in a minor league managing role is something that I've got a feeling maybe it's something that could possibly happen down the road. But I've been in baseball and all aspects of it, from a player, a manager, a broadcaster, to someone that has, you know, pushed for minor league baseball in my hometown, and to see that dream realized. I've been very blessed, but I'm also a passionate follower of Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. I have been born again. I suffered through some horrific times after Hurricane Katrina and really went through some devastation that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. But through God's grace and through finally surrendering, I was able to be freed from alcohol addiction
and fantastic
drug abuse that had really haunted me for several years after Katrina. But my life has been transformed in a way that I'm very thankful, very blessed, and I actually travel around and speak at churches and to youth groups and speak to kids, using baseball as a platform and sharing the great things that baseball offers in life, the life lessons, but also magnifying it in a way to teach about God and teach about His grace, His mercy, and
awesome.
Love.
Yeah,
so I lead a pretty diverse lifestyle right now, but it's all centered around glorifying God, and my love of baseball has only grown, you know, during these times.
All right, well, fantastic, Barry. Where's the best place we can find information on you, learn more about you, and best of luck. And I'm your friend on Facebook, and I see the amazing pictures and how you're transforming people's lives and your family and everything, and it's great to see you're happy about life, and that's through your faith, and that's, I know that for a fact, Barry. You're smiling and happy, yeah.
Amen, Neil, and I thank you for having me on and allowing me to share my testimony and to share some of the experiences that God blessed me with. But my time in New York was amazing. I forever will be a New York Met, even though I played with other clubs. But most importantly, I'm on God's team, and anything I can do to help and lead others to him is what I'm all about these days. And I'm just thankful for this opportunity, Neil.
You're
God
welcome.
Bless you and have a good day.
All right. God bless. Take care. See you, Barry. Okay.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment.